What do CEOs need to know about sales these days? A lot. Outdated sales strategies and tactics plague most companies today. Listen to what innovative CEOs and experts have to say about how to change all that with Sales Talk for CEOs. Welcome to Sales Talk for CEOs. Today, we are going to talk about the terrifying art of finding a customer. And we have the author of this new book with us today. He's also the CEO of Predictable Revenue. And his company is one I know well because I actually served on their board. They help founders find their first customers and do a lot of other things, but I'll let him tell you more about that. But I'm really excited to share the journey of Colin Stewart because it's an interesting one with several twists and turns and pivots. So, Colin, welcome to the show.
It's good to see you again.
Oh, good to see you too. Really excited that we're going to have this time together today. All right. So let's start by having you just tell everyone a little bit about Predictable Revenue, who it serves, and how it serves them. And then we'll rewind and get the whole story.
Cool. I mean, in its most current iteration, and as you said, there's been a number of pivots. The most current iteration, we're helping founders find their first customers, build their first rev teams, and everything in between. We end up, as part of that, we end up doing a lot of work with Klay.com. I've been using it for the last couple of years and had the founders of Klay on my podcast in the early days. And so I had a chance to learn from them. And it's been a really fun journey, being able to do interesting things in Klay to help folks find their customers in unique ways is really interesting. Cause if you're like, we were trying to do cold outbound for, I mean, I think I started the first cold outbound agency 13 years ago. And like, I've seen many, many, many iterations of like what good looks like, and what good looks like now for just regular old cold email isn't very great. And so we're trying to do a different things, but we can get into that later.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk about that. And I think it's super important that you're focused on founders because you and I both have worked with a lot of founders. And what we know is it is hard to get those first customers. And a lot of founders don't really know how to do it because they haven't been in sales necessarily. I mean, I think it's probably 25% or less of founders that actually came from a sales role, had done sales or managed sales or really understand the whole go-to-market process even. So it can be terrifying, as we both know, and so important, right? And usually they reach out to their networks and they get a few customers that way, or at least get some conversations started. But then beyond that, where do they go? And I think what's important is that they slow down to speed up, because usually they're like, I just want to hire a salesperson and get out of the sales business as fast as humanly possible. But you and I both know that just isn't the way it works, right? The founder has to stay involved in sales. And so I love that you are so focused on that space and time where those founders really need that kind of advice. So we'll come back to that. But now I want to take everyone on a very interesting journey with you. Let's rewind back. I don't know. It's been quite a number of years now to before you started Predictable Revenue. You had a couple other companies and some interesting things happened. So let's go ahead and start there.
So I had spent, before starting my first company, I'd spent 10 years in sales, you know, selling a variety of different things, from cell phone contracts to kitchen cabinetry to high rises to diesel generators to mines to data centers. And I thought I knew sales fairly well. And being kind of I was fairly geeky kid, good with technology, not quite programmer engineer level, but like pretty good. Every company I worked for, I got brought into the CRM project. And so my first exposure to Salesforce was like 2006, 2005. I was a marketing intern and they needed to replace Maximizer because the VP couldn't get, remember trying to sync all the SQL databases because on all the reps' laptops over dial-up internet, like it was a mess. And I was like, hey, this whole cloud thing seems like it's probably going to be pretty good. And like, since then, every company I work for, I got pulled into the CRM selection project. And man, the number of times you go through this loop all the time, you're like, wow, Salesforce is amazing because it connects all the laptops, especially considering reconnecting, you know, 30 SQL databases on laptops that just weren't working. But what we, as salespeople, what we lost was that Maximizer, Act, Goldmine, these tools were our personal productivity system.
Right.
These, I set them up, I defined the stages, I defined the process, I owned it. When everything went to Salesforce, my boss owns it, or an admin owns it, or, right, it's not mine anymore. It's my boss's tool for getting their reports, which isn't bad. It's just not what Maximizer was to me anyway. And so I saw this as the two things that didn't make sense, that yes, Salesforce is good and salespeople seem to have lost this thing. And so I had this insight. And then I just thought I was like the Steve Jobs of CRM, and pretty sure I said those words out loud. It's embarrassing, but I'm old enough to admit that I was an idiot back then. I still am an idiot, but a more advanced caveman idiot than I was back then. And I took this insight and I started a CRM company, and we had hockey stick growth right off the get-go. We went 0 to 1 customer before I even quit my full-time job. You think about a hockey stick though, is facing the wrong direction. It just kind of plateaued at one, and it sort of stayed there at one customer for about 18 months because I was building my idea. I wasn't building what customers wanted. And I'd read books by Cindy Alvarez on customer development and how to talk to customers. But what I got stuck on was the idea of customer validation. And I thought it was idea validation. It was validate my idea. It was look at what I'm doing. Isn't that great? And even though I was following the playbook, I had this attitude of like, see, this is a great idea. And they went, yeah, sure. And then when I came back and I was like, hey, look what we built it. They're like, nice. I'm like, do you want to buy it? And they're like, no. And so we basically rammed our head against that wall for 18 months.
Hard lesson, right? And for everyone, take that in, CEOs, whether you're starting up and building products or whether you're building new products as add-ons or even just looking at your existing products, mm-hmm. what does the customer think? What do they want or need? Not what do you want to build for them, right?
Right. And it has to be this balance of like what I believe should exist in the world, because that's why you're dumb enough to start a tech company in the first place. Right. So you have to kind of suspend that and hold it at the same level with, okay, I need to take this and then also go figure out how, like, I think this is the problem that they want to solve, or this is the solution I can build. And then we got to go find who experiences this problem the most deeply. And when I finally pulled my head out of my ass and started asking people that question, I noticed that sales development leaders were like, hey, we are experiencing this problem the most, because this was 12, 11 years ago. As an SDR operating in Salesforce, it was 27 clicks to add a new company, a new person, and send a cold email. 27 clicks. And this is Internet Explorer, I don't know, 8, 9 at the time. And so it's going to refresh the page every time. Like it wasn't pre Gmail, but Salesforce at the time felt pre Gmail. There was no Ajax. There was no, anyway. And so I was really frustrated by that and wanted to solve this for the SDRs because they had the greatest amount of pain. And so when we kind of started asking SDR leaders, hey, what sucks in your life? Everybody said the sales, like the productivity problem. We're like, oh, this might be a thing. And we had bootstrapped the company, and so we were offering services along the way, and we had actually been doing the like outbound or outsourced cold email for a year already, and we'd worked out these little hacks and these scripts and these things to like automate this, and we're like, hey, would you pay us to do that for you? And I asked 5 people and I got 7 customers.
Wow.
And I was like, this is an indication that there's something here.
Like, literally, they need this.
I mathed out how many customers I could handle. And I was like, okay, I think 5 is my absolute maximum because I'm going to be the man behind the curtain pulling all the things and doing all of this manually. And then 2 of the people I talked to bullied me into taking their friend on. Like in the interview, they're like, hang on a sec. James, yeah, you in? This is what this kid can do. Yeah. Okay, cool. James is in too. And like, I didn't have a choice. I mean, I'm a dirty salesperson, so of course I'm going to say yes, but it was that November was extremely challenging because it was more than I could handle, but it was amazing to have this feeling of the rock is finally rolling downhill as opposed to you're slowly pushing it up and you feel like if you just go away for the weekend, it's going to roll back down.
Yeah, that's a bad place to be, right? And we don't want boulders rolling back down on us. All right. So here you are, you figured out, and this was now, like you said, at least 10 years ago, you figured out how to write an email that would actually get someone's attention. And so this was big news for a lot of people because they weren't able to do it. Now we know that things have changed even more, right? But what were some of the elements of that email that made it something people wanted to respond to? And how did you know that? How did you get good at doing that?
You know, I'm not, if I look back at the emails that I wrote, I'm not sure I was great at doing it, at writing the emails, because almost all the emails were, I'm pretty sure I found this. Basically, the way I got good at it, I stalked Aaron Ross and Brian Kruzenberger. I was on every webinar. I found their personal information. It's called social selling now, but back then it was called being an internet stalker. And I was that guy. I followed them everywhere. I found their templates. I found this. I would email them, ask them questions. And I boiled it down to a couple of templates. And one was like, sorry to bother you. Can you point me in the direction of the person that handles X at your company? Which is a variation of like one of Aaron's cold call scripts that he uses, like his lost lamb approach. And so I just took that, turned it into an email. And that's basically the email we sent for most of our customers.
And the innovation.
It worked. Yeah, we would like, if we got under a 10% reply rate, we'd be like, oh, something's wrong. SDR is listening now.
10% reply rate. Like people would die to have a 10% reply rate right now.
Totally. Totally. And I think what we had, like the innovation that we brought was in the process and the fact that you didn't have to do this through Salesforce. You could, you know, do this a whole lot quicker. You know, back in the day, SDRs were sending like 10 emails a day. That was their like quota. And so, you get a 10% reply rate, you get one deal or one reply, one opportunity. And like, it was unique back then. And so that was the kind of innovation as we brought the process and eventually turned that service into a software tool.
Oh my gosh. Now it's like 1,000 to 1, I think, on email. I don't know. You have any stats on that?
Yeah. I mean, I run I've been mentoring a couple guys that have cold email agencies for the last few years. And, I didn't want to be doing it anymore. And I had a few friends that were doing it. And so I've been trying to share like, hey, avoid my mistakes. And, so I talked to them quarterly and I think it's 1-2% is the average reply rate with just straight cold email. There are some other things you can do to get much, much higher, but we could probably get into them a bit later.
My goodness. All right. So here you are now. You've got this figured out. It's working. So people are hiring you. Where does it go from there?
So we spent about a year as like the man behind the curtain, the Wizard of Oz beta is what we kind of called it, where we were providing the output of what we wanted the software to be while we were building the software. And slowly it went from, you know, me pulling the button or pulling the buttons, turning the cranks, whatever you want to say, to like actual software. That took about a year. And then we got to a point where Outreach had launched. SalesLoft was still wasn't doing Cadence yet. They were still doing, well, SalesLoft was like, go to LinkedIn, get somebody's email address. That's what SalesLoft was.
Yeah.
Pre-Cadence. And so they were still doing that, but we heard that they were going to be pivoting into Cadence. And so we were trying to get Carb out as quickly as possible, which was, you know, we would supply the list, like our team would go build that for you. And then Carb would send the emails and then help you reply to the emails. And so when we launched that, it was, I think we went 0 to 1 million in ARR in 3 months.
Wow. Wow. And did you implode?
Yes. And there was a number of mistakes. They were mostly technical problems, but they all generated from the idiot CEO who made some really bad prioritization calls about what the engineering team needed to build. I was so worried about keeping up with Outreach and going feature parity with Outreach that the team had told me in the early days, they're like, hey, we had basically pivoted our code base from the CRM product that nobody wanted. And our CTO was like, hey, we can take 5% of this code base and just build something off of it. And it'll be a quick janky hack. But then our services business on top of that quick janky hack became so popular so quickly that we didn't really have time to go back, or I didn't let them go back and say, hey, take a month, take 2 months, take the time you need and build the software, right? Like actually build something purpose built to solve this problem. Instead, we just said, no, this is good enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. Keep pushing. Oh, now we've got to add calling. We have to add, like, we must have pushed that rock for so long. And what happened was the software just got to a point where there were too many people. There were so many people using it on such old and inefficient code that you would go to click a button in Carb to send an email. And 2 weeks later, that email would make its way through the system.
Brutal.
It's hard to imagine, but yeah, it was bad. And like, these sound like technical problems, but it was all 100% my fault. Mm. And so we did get to 0 to 1 million in 3 months. And then we watched that flywheel just turned from extremely positive. Like all of our business was coming from referrals. I interviewed 5 people and then they told 5 people and they told 5 people and they told 5 people. And I was having like 5 to 10 meetings every day, just like showing off the software. And like, people didn't even care what color it was. They're like, if it solves the problem that you say it does, and we can prove that in the first month, then like, you've got our business. And
wow. Like everyone wishes for that kind of inbound, right?
It was crazy. Yeah. And it wasn't like inbound, like, oh, people found us on TechCrunch. It was inbound. Like a VP of sales said, hey, this thing does something that was impossible 3 months ago.
Yeah. Word of mouth, right? It spreads like wildfire. And especially if you can do what you say you can do. Now that broke down. So what happened next?
That's a long and kind of ugly story, but basically we got up to 1 million and then kind of plateaued there, right? Because we were still bringing on lots of customers because there was still a lot of referral. We were getting a pretty positive flywheel, or referrals from the flywheel. But once the software started slowing down, that flywheel stopped. And all of a sudden we had hit this plateau and new sales were just barely keeping up a churn.
Wow.
And we kind of got stuck there where we managed to, you know, fix a bunch of things, but we kind of missed our opportunity because we grew too fast too quickly. Sounds crazy to say, but had we gone a little bit slower and not taken on as many customers and then taken our opportunity to learn and say, hey, you know what, let's not go 0 to 60 as fast as possible. Let's take this slow and actually build something that customers are going to love. I think we would, there's a different version of reality that Carb is probably still alive, but we didn't. And it took a couple of years for it to eventually die. And I think 2014 to 2018 was sort of the lifespan of that tool. And we ended up shutting it down because we only had a few customers at the end of 2018. And the server costs were, just to keep it alive, were more than the revenue was worth to us. And I remember shutting it down and like one of the customers actually cried because she loved Carb so much. And I was like, you are breaking my heart. And this software is killing me financially. I was like, so like, I'll give you the code if you want to keep using it, but then you're gonna have to do all this. But yeah, I still remember that call and it was, I mean, amazing that somebody loved your software that much and then heartbreaking that it was, just not financially viable to run anymore.
Yes, such hard lessons, and it's painful and it's emotional. And, you know, we, as founders, you know, we expect some of this, but it's still hard. And then you've got to carry on and go to your next thing. All right. So that happened. You shut it down. Mm-hmm. What was next? What did you start doing?
Yeah, this coincided with probably one of the dumbest pivots I've made, which was moving from doing just purely cold email to outsource SDR. And right around 2018, 2019, what we recognized, I think it was end of 2018, we recognized email reply rates had been dropping and were on a pretty steep decline. And multi-touch was the new hotness. Everybody was using Outreach and Sales Loft, and they're personalizing the first touch and then dialing based on opens. Yeah. Like that was the thing. So we said, okay, well, let's do that. And we had a team in Mexico that was doing some research for us and doing some running some of our marketing. And we thought, well, you know, we found great people down there for this and they all speak fantastic English. What if we built an outsource team that helped find more of these folks jobs and gave a pretty great product to our customer for a pretty reasonable rate? And so we did that. And I would say those things were mostly true throughout the lifetime, the existence of the SDR program. I think what I learned through that is that I don't love running a big SDR team. I think we peaked at 50 SDRs, and I know folks that absolutely love managing people, managing teams of teams, managing the SDR motion. And I'm not one of them. I love starting a company. I love kind of going that zero to one. And I couldn't find a way to articulate this. I mean, you were on the board, you saw me, and you would ask me questions and I wouldn't be able to respond because I was like, Alice, I just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good to realize though, but right. Like and just for everybody to catch them up, this is into the predictable revenue days now. So we're done with CARB and started into predictable revenue with this big SDR team and with your co-founder, Aaron Ross, and you guys were into doing this. Now, it was interesting times, right? Because Aaron had proved that this could work at Salesforce.com when he was there. And this is just my opinion and my retrospective. It worked for a minute, right? Maybe a couple minutes, right? But then everybody started copying and doing it so poorly that I felt like it sort of brought the system down. Like you guys were doing it well. You were like, hey, we can take this, we can do it, we can make this work. And you did. But I feel like everyone else kind of made the whole thing tumble down because they did it so poor. Like, oh, we can do this. We can have people dial for dollars and blah, blah, blah. Hire a bunch of SDRs. But it really didn't work for them because they didn't get it maybe, or they weren't doing it well.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things because I've thought about this a lot. And I remember seeing people say, oh, predictable revenue is dead. And then I'm looking at some of our bigger clients where we had five or six SDRs that were extraordinarily profitable for them. So I'm like, this is clearly not true. Some of the biggest, fastest growing software companies have used sales development, are using sales development, and are getting fantastic returns on it. I think there was kind of two things happening. The first thing was that you're familiar with crossing the chasm, the idea of like the technology adoption lifecycle. I feel like demand gen channels like cold email, like sales development, follow a similar pattern where the innovators, the early adopters get the majority of the benefit from that channel. Once you cross that chasm, early majority gets some, but that's where it starts. The channel starts to get crowded. It'll still work, but the janky, like sorry to bother you templates that worked in 2012 aren't going to work anymore. And the more people that come to the channel, the more information that's publicly available to everybody, the more people there are with experience in the channel, the more tools that are purpose-built for the channel, the higher the table stakes get. So the better your game needs to be. And I think a lot of people were looking at predictable revenue, the book, as the playbook in 2018 and saying, oh, we can just do this, not realizing that, I mean, the book was written about Aaron's experience from 2005, 2006.
Yeah, early.
The book was written in 2010, released in 2011. And so they're looking at a book going, oh, we'll just copy this playbook, not recognizing that it's a 15-year-old playbook and it needs to evolve.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I think too, like when I'm a senior executive and I'm not getting that much email and I get one, sorry to bother you, can you direct me email in a month? I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Let me do. But when I start getting five a day, I'm like, wait a minute, what is going on here? And I'm just deleting, right? Because now I'm realizing, oh, this is a cold outreach tactic that has become popular and everybody's using it. So I think that was part of the demise as well, right? Because you can't use this. It's like the idea is use a topic to break in, but don't use the same exact topic for every single one of your SDRs and, you know, thousands of them, because now everyone's getting hundreds of these. Oh, sorry to bother you. Can you point me in the right direction emails?
Totally. And it used to be hard to build a list. It used to be hard to send a bunch of emails. And so when it was hard, you were very intentional. With the proliferation of all the tools, it became easier and you got a lot more careless about dumping a bunch of prospects into Apollo, click and drag in and set and go, because you don't have to put that much work into it. And when you don't have to put that much work into it, you don't invest in it, things get sloppy. And I've been just as guilty of that as anybody else, if not more. And so I think there was a lot of that. I think this also coincided with, there was a kind of run up in SaaS of the investment, especially in the zero interest days. And there was so much money going into startups and predictable revenue was the playbook. And so that kind of spurred the proliferation of you got to have an SDR team. And I think Jason Lemkin was amazing at getting the word out. And I think that kind of, it was a boon and kind of its undoing because everybody was doing it. And you get a lot of people saying, oh, it's not working for us. And it's like, well, it's not working for you because it's not profitable. Like it is producing meetings. It is producing pipeline.
Right. But the cost of sale is way too high now.
Exactly. And like, I think a lot of startups used it and we helped them. We helped a lot of startups get meetings, create pipeline. And then stuff wasn't closing or some would come to us and just get nothing. And they're like, oh, this channel isn't working. And this is kind of what inspired the book was the idea that like the way that you get customers is you need to have something that is wrong. There needs to be something wrong in their life that they're willing to make a change. But there has to be something there already. Nobody wanted to buy my crappy CRM because they already had Salesforce. They were satisfied. There was CRM and salesperson productivity was a really important problem, but they were 9, 8 out of 10 satisfied with how they were currently solving it. When I found SDR, it was a 10 out of 10 problem and 2 out of 10 satisfaction. And I think a lot of people don't recognize that the strength of your product market fit is going to be a multiplier of your go-to-market efforts.
And right. So, we found that when I was working with you, remember we had some clients that we took a look at and I was like, wow, they really don't have product market fit. So it doesn't matter what we do. They're mm-hmm. not going to be able to get an appointment. And I think it's really critical. And you said something really important. There's no reason to change. Right. And Miller Hyman speak, which, you know, we would say mm-hmm. they're not in trouble or growth. People only buy when they're in trouble or growth. That's it. Right. Thank you. If they're, you know, overconfident, like, oh, never had so good, like, why would I change? Or even keel, like, I don't really see any problems here. I mean, we're going along, right? Then they're not going to buy. They either have to be like, oh my gosh, in my world, this is a problem. This is trouble. It's impacting me personally, my department, my people, and I cannot go forward. I need to put this fire out. I need to stop this problem right now, right? Of course, mm-hmm. that's going to create the most urgency for them. But then also there's this, when they feel there's a tremendous growth that could happen, but we're stifled from doing it because if only I had a XYZ, mm-hmm. we could really grow. Like if they're not thinking in either of those two modes, these individual humans who buy mm-hmm. from you, they're not going to move. They're not going to change. They're not going to buy. And that exactly. makes it hard, right? Because you've got to find those humans who need what you sell, who are likely to buy what you sell because of their situation, who mm-hmm. also feel this pain of, I've got a problem or I can't grow. So I need help, right? I need something.
Absolutely. If folks are listening and they haven't read This Is Selling Machine that you told me to buy, which I loved. I grew up on The New Strategic Sale, which is, I think came after this or no, maybe
first.
Before.
No, strategic selling and conceptual selling okay. were first. And actually Selling Machine came much later, but it came because okay. what we realized is the leaders didn't understand, right, how to build their funnel, their pipeline. They, and mm-hmm. they weren't understanding how to manage it. And so all these deals were stuck.
Yeah. So I know I'm here to promote my book, but Selling Machine, The New Strategic Sale, phenomenal books. I wouldn't have been able to write my book without those books. And thank like, you. I wouldn't have been able to do any of predictable revenue, anything that we accomplished without Miller Hyman. And so I'm
eternally grateful. We'll put Selling Machine in the show notes for sure. I'll put all my dev books in the show notes for everybody because amazing. They are real basics for a complex sale, right? They give you the foundation for a complex sale.
100%. The customer that taught me that this was important, it wasn't even them trying to teach me. It was the results that we saw. Mm. And when we were fortunate enough, and I'm fortunate enough that Uber greenlit this, us to be able to share this publicly, because one of our previous customers, the VP of sales, got poached by Uber to go start their Uber. I think it was Uber Everything at the time. And basically what turned into Uber Eats. And he was their first VP of sales for their first B2B sales team. And they're like, Colin, I need a whole bunch of meetings with the top 50 restaurants in every city in North America. I was like, okay, I can do that. And we basically took one account strategist, and she was producing on average for 5 or 6 clients about 60 meetings a month. So like,
wow,
pretty good for one human, right? This was still using Carb, doing all the things. We had a bunch of scale. It was great. When we launched with Uber, this same human, the same tools, actually sending fewer emails, better list, but fewer, only 1,000 emails in January. Guess how many meetings she booked off of 1,000 emails?
More, I think, because maybe she was more targeted.
She booked 327 meetings.
Oh my gosh.
Oh. In the first month off of 1,000 emails.
Wow.
And we were like, it broke everything. It
how
broke
did
my
she
brain.
Do it?
She was still the same awesome Krista, who was still generating, who would have generated 60 meetings for a bunch of other regular customers. But this was Uber launching Uber Eats. The pain of restaurant owners of having to pay a delivery driver. This was the strength of product market fit, giving her a 5-6x or giving Uber a 5-6x more out of our service, because their strength of their product market fit was just carrying them so much.
Wow.
And that was the moment where I was like, holy crap. The stronger your product market fit, the more you're going to get out of our services. I wish I caught that right away, but it took me a while for that to kind of grind in. And look, we had a few of their fast followers. You've probably heard as well. Can't mention them because they didn't approve this, but we worked with some of their fast followers, and there were 2 or 3 different cohorts. And every time, like Uber got 327, the next fast follower got 60 in the first month, and then 12, and then like 0, because the problem was solved. Right. Everybody went from like 10 out of 10 importance to and 1 out of 10 satisfied with how we're currently solving it to like 4 to 10, 8 out of 10. And once people are 7 or 8 out of 10 satisfied, there's really no need to go take another look at a solution. And so when you're doing cold email campaigns or sales development campaigns to folks that are trying to rip and replace, it's going to be significantly harder to going to folks and saying, do you have a hair on fire problem? I know this looks like a brick, but it'll put the fire out. And they're like, sure, I'll try it. Because I've tried everything else.
And my hair is still on fire. So yeah, right? Absolutely. So, all right. So you're realizing all these things as we're moving along in predictable revenue. I know that you made a couple pivots when I was on the board, and then you made further pivots. But then this idea to write this book struck you. So let's talk about, how did you get this idea? Like, what was burning inside you? Because writing a book is no easy task. And you know that. So I'm real curious, why did you decide to do it, right? And you know, what were the thoughts around it? And what were you thinking it would do for your current go-to-market model?
Yeah, I mean, it was a few years ago, and one of my board members was encouraging me to write a follow-up, a sequel to Predictable Revenue. I think you might know them fairly well.
Yes.
And I started writing the sequel to Predictable Revenue, and I hated it. I hated the writing. I hated the work. I didn't love the topic. I didn't care about sales development anymore. But I had this really interesting kind of insight based on the experience with Predictable Revenue. And it was the idea around the 4 funnels that basically one of my biggest frustrations alongside the product market fit thing was that we booked a bunch of meetings for a lot of customers, and they would look at them and go, no, we don't want to take that meeting. I'm like, why not? And they're like, well, there's no project in the next 90 days. They don't have anything they want to buy from me right now. And I'm like, you got to do the work. And even the ones that would take the meeting, the reps would never follow up with them again, because they're like, oh, there's nothing on the books. I'm like, but this is the right person at your ideal client. They're like, yep. And they have some pain. They're like, yep. I'm like, but they don't want to buy right now. They're like, yep, garbage. I'm like, not garbage.
They did not understand the complex sale, obviously, right? It doesn't, totally. You don't just meet this person once and they buy from you. It is a process of getting them to know you and trust you and adding insights so that when they are ready, bam, it's so easy.
It's, in some ways, it's better to meet these folks early, because now you get this opportunity to be a real salesperson and to help them understand the problem and to be the person that helps shape their understanding of the problem.
Yeah, it moves it from transactional, right? Which is what they were doing when they were telling you, no, don't want this one. That's a transaction. That's like, no, that's not the way it works, right? Mm-hmm. It's a process.
Exactly. And so this to me was, I was trying to get founders to understand this, and I couldn't. And so I came up with the idea of, there are actually 4 funnels. And this last funnel is the nurture funnel. You have your prospecting funnel, you have your customer success funnel or account management funnel, whatever you want to call it. And then you've got your closing funnel, right? And like, those are the three that everybody thinks about, but everybody mm-hmm. forgets about their nurture funnel. And so I was writing SQL to Predictable Revenue. I'm like, this is going to be the book. And it just wasn't good enough. Like, the four funnels idea was really interesting and really helpful, but I didn't care that much. Like, I cared about that, but I didn't care about anything else that was going around it. And at the time, I had ran into a friend of a friend, Michael Tuso, who had written a book on customer success.
Yeah.
Fantastic sales development leader, just amazing. He had introduced me to Trina, the founder of Page Two. So if you know, obviously Awesome or The Coaching Habit, they had produced both of those books. And I was talking to Trina and I showed it to her and she's like, okay, good, but not good enough. And here's what's missing. And it on reflection, like, I cared about this one idea, but I didn't care about the rest of it. Mm. And so I was starting to write the newsletter and I was starting to write about, okay, what are the things that I care about? What are the hills that I would die on? And one of those is the strength of your product market fit is a multiplier of your go-to-market efforts. And so I started shaping the book around that and around the idea that founders absolutely, absolutely, no questions asked, do not pass go, do not collect $200, need to be the person that closes their first few sales up to probably a few million, like a million in revenue.
Yeah.
Somewhere in between there, maybe you can hand it off. But once I started getting into that, I realized the book wasn't for sales development teams. It was for founders. And as soon as I had that realization, that framing, everything just started flowing and snapping into place. And I went from like, this is a thing I'm doing for the company to like, this is a thing I'm doing for me. This is summarizing what I learned because I went through a painful 12, 13 year journey of screwing all these things up. And so I'm just going to be candid about, these are all the dumb things I did. Try to make new mistakes, but like, don't make these ones. Here's some of the things I learned and hopefully this is helpful. And once I had that kind of frame in mind, writing a book was easy. It was just sitting down Fridays and like trying to get through the like learning how to write, but that became easy. I just did it every Friday and probably took about a year to get the initial manuscript pumped out, but it was finding that frame that was the real breakthrough.
So it's interesting because you were writing a book to help the company propel itself. You were, mm-hmm. you know, the book that was written originally, The Predictable Revenue, was old. And also it was old when it was written, right? The methods that mm-hmm. were in it were already 10 years old, probably by the time it was written. So it was definitely getting a point across and people were using it, but it wasn't working anymore. And, mm-hmm. you know, so it wasn't really relevant, although people would glom onto, oh my gosh, this is the playbook, like you were saying, but it's like, yeah, but no, this playbook doesn't really work anymore. We need to improve it. So you were going to try to do that. And I remember talking with you about that and like, would this be a good idea? And should we mm-hmm. rewrite, you know, the new version and what's working today and all of that. And it's interesting to me, and I'm so glad that you really discovered that that wasn't what you were interested in, right? Because it's just, when you write a book from your heart about what you really care about, it's going to make mm-hmm. a huge difference. Would that rewrite of the other, bringing it up to what works today, help the company? Oh, maybe, I don't know, right? But would this help the company more when you write something from your heart that you really care about and it has helped you pivot? But in any case, writing a book is a very creative way to let everyone know what you know, share it with them, and also attract them, right, to your company. And I think that today we need a lot more creative methods for attracting our ideal customers. I mean, there are people out there who need what we sell. Otherwise, we'd be out of business, right? And so if we know that, it's our job to go find them. Now, maybe they're not buying right now, but they're going to buy eventually. Mm-hmm. We've got to do that. But when we only rely on outbound, and especially in many industries, outbound just isn't working at all anymore. I mean, to some mm-hmm. degree, it's working in some industries. But as we said, the response rates are very low and salespeople are not having the amount of conversations that they need to every week to hit their goals, right? So thinking about other ways to augment that. Not that you shouldn't do outbound. You should do it really well, though, if you're going to do it. And it needs to be augmented with lots of other things. And I love this idea of a CEO writing a book about the things they care most about to mm-hmm. help their company grow. So tell me about how that hit you. Because I think at first, that's probably not what you were thinking necessarily.
No, I was thinking, I don't want this. I was looking at my manuscript and I was like, I hate this. I was looking at predictable revenue and I'm like, I hate this. And we were having very profitable years and I hated it. And it wasn't the people, we had great people and I couldn't reconcile. Yeah. I'm like, this is a great company. It's producing profit and I'm deeply unhappy.
And I so remember the conversations that we had and you mentioned it earlier where I would ask you like, what do you really want to do, Colin? Like, what do you care? And you're like, I don't know. I mean, it was a tough time for you. You were trying to keep your company growing, driving revenue, you know, making things work. And it was hard because in your heart, right, you weren't there. And this is, I think, one of the so important things for CEOs today and especially going into the future. It's like, what do you want to create, right? What do you want your life to be about, right? Build your business around that because then you will be happy no matter what.
Totally. And I felt bad not being able to give you an honest answer. And I think what I didn't want to admit to myself or to you was that, and I'll give you the honest answer now, what did I want to do back then? I wanted to shut down the outsourcing. Yes. I just wanted to murder that and just help founders figure out growth so that I could spend some time not managing this company that I hated, doing this thing that I don't love anymore, so that I could start figuring out what my next thing is. And I wanted to get back to starting a software company again.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And I knew in your heart, that's what you wanted to do, but you wouldn't say it to me. I remember because I said, what would it feel like? Like just walk into this with me. Do you remember this conversation? Like what would it feel like if you just shut it all down, Colin? Like how would that feel? And you just couldn't go there. You just weren't ready. Like
I couldn't. Yeah. It was, I think partly you were 100% right. And I was stuck on loyalty to the people that had given so much time to predictable revenue, shutting down something that was doing meaningful work for companies. Like I just wasn't brave enough, wasn't strong enough. It wasn't bad enough yet. And like, had I only known what was coming next, I would have been like, yeah, let's do it. Because there were some messy, hard years. And like a company can't survive if the founder hates the company, hates what you do, and doesn't hate the company, doesn't hate the customer, but hates what we're doing for the customer.
Yeah.
You know, like it was just, it was a challenging couple of years.
Oh my gosh. All right. So you wrote the book.
Yeah.
And I love the title, The Terrifying Art of Finding a Customer, right? And I love that you put that word in there because people are probably afraid to say that and founders don't want to even admit it, but it is terrifying in many ways, right? And especially when you're first beginning and you were from sales when you founded your company, but you realize that didn't even really help you that much, right? But when you have no idea, you're not from sales, but it's not just the founders. And I know you wrote it for founders, but I think of all the CEOs that I work with that are 10 or 20 years in, and it's still terrifying because maybe they've opened a new market or maybe things have changed and they need to pivot. And when you pivot, will we be able to find a new customer? Will our current customers stay with us? Like it is terrifying. Now, as CEOs, we don't go around being terrified or we wouldn't be able to run our companies. Right? And we are risk takers as founders. That's a part of being an entrepreneur. But deep down inside, we feel that way. And to put it right on the cover of the book, I was like, yeah, good work, Colin, because I think that is true. I mean, it's not stopping us, but we feel that way. And maybe it's even propelling us when we feel a bit terrified, right? Okay. So you wrote the book and it's coming out when?
October 28th.
All right, great. So we'll put that in the show notes so everybody can pre-order their books. So that'll be fantastic. And how do you foresee this book propelling the company? Yeah, I mean, it wasn't your original intention. You just wanted to do something you love and share that with everybody. And I love that. But kind of in the back of your mind, you had to be thinking, yeah, I think this can really help our company grow. So what do you think is next with the book and how is it going to help you drive business?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book and realized this is the work I want to do. Like this is what's going to bring me energy. This is the kind of company that I want to build. This is what I would be happy helping folks do. And I think for me, it was the process of writing the book was as important to me in terms of getting my head around what I wanted to do as it is for marketing the book or selling for the company. I think one thing that's been incredible with writing the book is I started writing a newsletter to build that writing muscle, to get comfortable with sharing. And what it resulted in was this value first relationship first approach with the audience. And I think that's one of the things that's working extremely well with Outbound, is instead of starting with, hey, let me sell you some stuff, hey, let's start with creating a relationship. You know, let me share some content that I think might be helpful to you. Let me, you know, let's do something together that is going to be beneficial to both of us. And I think that shift got me to, you know, the services that we're offering now with predictable revenue, that has helped me figure out how to help some of our clients unlock some growth. And it's just been a fantastic learning experience for me. So I can't say enough. It was a journey. It was a lot of work, but it was absolutely worth it. Oh. And we're already probably a month and a half away from the launch, or from when this episode's going to go live. And we're already at a couple hundred pre-orders. So I'm pretty excited.
Love that. Oh my gosh. Well, I really appreciate you sharing your journey and the fact that you were so open and honest about it, because all the CEOs listening, you know, we've all been through stuff as founders of our companies, as, you know, now that we're 10 years or even 20 years in, right? Gosh, we all have stories to tell, and we learn so much from each other by just sharing, you know, and I think we just don't do enough of it. So I really thank you for that. And just before we go, I have a couple of questions I want to ask you. And the first one is, what is a book that you think every CEO should read?
Hands down, Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. I mean, I'll say, I've already said one, which was The New Strategic Selling. Like, right. I like Selling Machine, but New Strategic Selling, and then Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. The thing I got from that book was I had never done anything strategic before. All the things I had done were just OKRs, which is just planning. It was the last step in the process.
And really more leading to tactics. I think that's what a lot of companies do. They think they're doing strategic planning, but there's really nothing strategic about it. It's all about tactics.
I'm looking at these stupid orange binders, and not stupid because EOS is bad, but EOS got us so pulled into tactical that we got stuck doing the exact same thing, and we weren't thinking strategically at all. It was all execution, execution, execution. Even though they have the, like, one day this and this and that, there was no strategy in there, and, like, not a fault of EOS. This was just how we had implemented it. So Good Strategy, Bad Strategy was the book that pulled my head out of my ass.
Wow. Excellent. All right. Next question is, what's a podcast you listen to because it makes you think differently?
Acquired.fm.
Ooh, I haven't even heard of that one. Okay.
Oh, you got to check it out. So
I will.
They're venture capitalists or angel investors, VCs turned, I would say, business historians. And so they look at every, like, they're currently doing Google. They've done Microsoft. They've done Berkshire Hathaway. They've done Sega, Nintendo, all these great companies. And it's not an hour long podcast. It's a couple hours, like, minimum. Ooh. You're committing to, like, 2-3 hours. I think Berkshire Hathaway was total like 12 hours split between 3 or 4 episodes. So they go deep. It is incredible. And it's not your typical biography of the company told through a glorified lens. It's told from 2 venture capitalists that are looking at the strategic importance of the company, the decisions they made, how the company evolved, where they went right, where they went wrong. And so from a business history perspective, I haven't found any better content out there.
Wow. All right. Well, I will definitely start listening to that one. Okay. Last question is, what do CEOs need to know to win in this market?
I mean, you got to be going relationship first. Cold outbound, I wouldn't say is dead, but it's only working for the companies that have extremely strong product market fit. If you're a brand new company, you need to be leading with relationship first, value first messaging, not just, can I sell you some stuff?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Fantastic. Really enjoyed taking this journey with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out to be on the show today.
Alice, thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed the show, please like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.